Where are you going to have dinner?
I was going to go back to the hotel and check in with my colleagues after we finished up here. But, you say you have a class?
Yes. I'm taking a class in gilting. Twister frames, pinball picture frame. And we're mixing the rabbit skin glue and the gesso and putting the gold leaf on in a couple of weeks.
That's one of the wonderful things about being in an area like D.C. There are always so many things you can take advantage of.
Yeah. That's
right. Well, the Marshall then went to the South Pacific.
Yes.
In time for Saipan.
Saipan, Tinian, Guam, and the Second Battle of the Philippine Sea.
Okay, what role did you have?
Gunnery.
And what role did the Marshall play in these engagements?
She was in the fast carriers, screens around the fast carriers, and picket duty between, particularly the ones between Japan and the fast carriers, and then coming out from Okinawa or Japan itself, could interpose the picket line between there and operate around. But mostly it was just providing the screen and for anti-aircraft. I mean, I think we did do a little landing support on some of the landings, but mainly it was our job was to stay with the carriers and be in that outer screen just to protect the carriers. And the Second Battle of the Philippine Sea, of course, we got lots of shooting in there. The big turkey shoot day.
Right.
A lot of good gunnery on that ship. And on the day when they went after the Japanese task force and ran out of, they got a false position report, the first position report in the Japanese task force. And they launched all the planes to attack it after they had been gone for an hour or so. They had a second position report. And the enemy was quite a further than originally reported. So it became obvious to everybody who was listening in on the traffic that these guys couldn't get there and back and land. We're going to have a lot of losses in the hit. We had a lot all that night. We were up in lights in the whole cash room. First lights up in the air, running lights in the ship. Things I hadn't seen for 3 years. And our planes were coming back.
Did that increase the danger to the task force by being lit up like that? It looked like that made it perfect for subs?
Perfect for submarines, yeah. Or for any other attacking aircraft that might be around. But it was the chance they had to take, because these planes came back, maybe they would have enough fuel to make one pass on the carrier for a landing. Or maybe none. They had to land in the water.
There was no thought of moving the task force closer to the...
Oh, we went like out of help. And the time that position report came in, they launched the last aircraft. We turned around at flank speed to close the distance. And I remember the carriers could go faster than the destroyer.
Right.
Any kind of a sea, and they even went out ahead of us and left their escorts. You know, it was that serious in the event of the recovery of the planes. And then, unfortunately, in order to recover, they had to turn around and widen the gap again because of prevailing winds that worsened the situation every time they were recovering. It was stretch out the distance. And I don't know how many planes were lost. Yes, a few hundred, but they replenished next week or so.
You're losing a lot of power, a lot of manpower there also.
Yeah,
as well as the
most
plane.
Of the manpower seemed to survive. We picked up. I think we brought in about six or eight pilots the next day. We steamed on the path that they had taken in and back on the destroyer line of rest screen. Picking up everything in the
And the water, everything was calm and the water was warm and everything, right. So they could survive.
Sharks came in the water when picking up the rubber boats, you know, a shark would be out. Sniffing around a cigarette pack or something, the screw had thrown open. Thompson submachine gun from the bridge. I remember shooting a shark, blood spurting the other sharks. Men were glad to see us.
You were actually quite lucky, though, that the Japanese did not have a number of submarines out there.
We were.
Because
they could have taken their toll. Yeah. One humorous event was that there was in the middle of all this melee, you know, darkness and lights on and jammed up flight decks, you know. Guys come in with shot up or something, you know. One fellow came in against orders because they had not yet cleared the flight deck. Got the aircraft had landed, broke the landing gears, and they couldn't taxi up in front of the barrier, so the flight deck was fouled. And this aviator said he was coming in, and the landing officer said, "You can't come in, the flight deck is fouled." He says, "I'm coming in anyway. My last pass," he said, "I have absolutely no gas left." And he did come in, and he ran into the plane that was parked there. He killed the crewman who was in the back seat of the plane. That's something to live with.
It's like been better to ditch his plane and let them pick him up.
We had no problem with that. I don't think we lost a single pilot. Planes ditched easily, you know, that's why. But the incident that I started to tell you about was in the midst of all this melee. There was one plane up there circling with a red light flashing. There was a Japanese plane. And he was lost off Saipan or Tinian or someplace, you know, looking for a place to land. And you would come around buzzing on the carrier, and he wanted to land aboard, didn't he? Well, of course, he would have followed up the flight deck. But they took him out to wait until he was out on the perimeter and shot him down. I forget whether they recovered him or not. He would have made a good POW.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
So.
Well, speaking of Japanese aircraft at this point, your kamikazes have come into play by this time, have they not?
Oh, yes, yeah, right.
All your experiences. I know later on there was some testing of trying to improve the response
defensive
to kamikazes, but at this point in time, what was your experience?
Well, we had some, but that came close, and we had one night that we were out alone on picket duty. Japan here, moon here, we were right in the shimmer of the moon. And he came in on us and went right over that stack level. We got up a few rounds at it. Got around quickly and he disappeared. I don't know whether we claimed him or not, but we couldn't find any visible evidence that we had.
You mean see him hit the water?
I think we did. We couldn't prove it. He came right in at us and dropped the torpedo. And dropped it right out here. And then the crew saw the bubbles. It must have run deep under us. But he had no reason to miss, absolutely no reason to miss. But we were there in the shimmer of the moon. Opened fire a little ways out, but he should have dropped by the time we were on opening fire.
What kind of feeling did you get? I know things were moving so fast that you don't have time to stop and think about your feeling, but seeing that torpedo drop right in your path, what?
you just try to do the best you can.
You react.
You react, that's right. I was up on the I had the deck when he was coming in. I called the skipper. Then you have a deck officer, a communication officer, usually there's a deck officer off the deck during the battle. I called Don, I called the skipper. The skipper came out and I wanted to go to General Porter because I'd watched this thing develop along with had good radar. Go to General Porter because that's why. This was not the skipper that we had before. This was another skipper we had on the one about like the first one. Go to General Quarters.
Well, let's look at it. Let's be sure.
So as soon as Don Amato, the watch officer, came up, I said, Don, go to General Quarters. I'm going to the director. So I handed it to him, pointed to what was going on. And I went up the ladder, dived in, just as I was diving into the gun director in the gunnery officer's position. And this guy, whoom, came over just like that. So there were. It happened so fast. You just. What are you going to do?
I thought you automatically went to General Quarters and then thought about it.
Yeah, you should have.
After you're in position.
You should have. I should have found a General Quarters before I called him. But he was a very, very strange man.
Any other specific incidents there in the South Pacific when you were with Marshall?
I picked up much of, I think, about 22 or 23 Japanese sailors who were off a sunken cruiser. And they got to see the enemy firsthand. Some of them were emaciated looking. They'd been at sea for quite some time in an open boat. Canvas cover. And one or two looked like they were well fed. The cook was well fed. Very fat guy, really. The rest of them were little. And baked and starved for some time. We got a lot of souvenirs out of that.
Well, now, did you have a. Where did you put on board ship? Where did you put prisoners like that?
We had them strip as they came aboard. And then put them up in the forecastle and under armed guard, and then we have a little place on the after kind of called tube alley where the propeller shaft goes through back in the long narrow compartments, and not much good for storage or anything back there. Put them back in there, carry them around for.
And they said you keep them on board until you go back into port, or
no?
Pass them over.
We passed them over by Bolson's share of the carriers, bigger ships later on. But we had them for a good time. But there's a brig aboard a destroyer, of sorts, not used for other things. There was no hostility that I could. On their part, or was there any crew towards them? They're curious about them. Glad to be aboard, I'm sure. Or thought, didn't know what was going to happen to them first, I'm sure. But gradually the ice became broken, and cigarettes were passed out. We were asked to assess them for those who appeared to be intelligent. Most intelligent, have any English capability, speaking capabilities, and those were the first ones passed over to for intelligence purposes, debriefed.
Well, no one aboard the Marshall could speak Japanese, though, could they?
I don't think so. No. Not so. It would be up to them to be able to speak a little pidgin English with them. A lot of souvenirs out of that.
I think so. Well, now, after the Second Battle of the Philippine Sea, you were transferred out of the Marshall, were you not?
Right.
And came back stateside to work on a project for trying to determine how to better respond to kamikaze flights.
Like a new ship, which was designed and built as a picket ship, Henry W. Tucker. And the Tucker was the one of the few that was built, or modified, I'm sure, in the latter stage of its building, with the best radar, additional guns, anything new coming along in ammunition, they were prepared for that. Mission of those ships were, so we were destined to go back out as a pickup, radar pickup.
Well, now, how, I think you mentioned in the first interview the fact that they, you had people from MIT and Harvard aboard trying to help design improved ways for dealing with kamikazes. How do you go about improving your response to kamikazes, trying to shoot them down before they can get to you, or what?
Right.
What did that consist of?
Well, different kinds of fusing, for example, barrage fusing, or everything out goes off at 500 yards or 1,000 yards or something like that, or VT fusing, testing different kinds of settings on VT fuses, proximity fuse, does it go off at 10 feet, 30 feet, whatever. Different kinds of director controls. Do you wait for a director, or do you use sight control individual guns? How much tracking do you put in before you open fire with 5-inch? Different kinds of gun sights for the 40 millimeters and the 20 millimeters, the old the one based on the gyroscopic action. Name of Mark something about it. But how do you do it? How do you train for it? How do you equip for it? What kind of ammunition do you use? What kind of tactics do you use?
The purpose is to try to shoot the plane down quicker before it gets so close to you.
Or chew it up, you know, when it gets in close. You know, one of the big faults of all gunners is opening up too soon. And you've expended your rounds by the time he gets within range. You wait until he's well within range. How do you estimate range? They had things that you hold out when the wings set the kind of airplane, when the wingspan fills the gap, then he's within range. A little simple things like that. But it boils down mostly to experience. Who's going to stand there with this?
I was getting ready to say, certainly wasn't modern computerized technology.
No. But that was for machine gun control, 20-millimeter gun control. And maybe you have, you know, one of the second loaders or somebody who's not occupied perform that function for you. But they took a lot of data, and we didn't want to work. We went out every day and fired with them. Towed sleeves, different kinds of targets for training, the whole retinue of
well, how do you simulate a kamikaze attack?
You don't really. Nothing coming in straight at you. Mm-hmm. There's no way in there. They had drones, you know, but they were, who was going to, even a drone coming in can, you know, do a lot of damage aboard a ship, mm-hmm. kill people, set a fire, and that sort of thing. So you don't. You have fast passing targets, for example. A plane flies low and fast up your beam or across the front of you or whatever. But you don't, or you do it by surprise drills. You put a spotting round out there, build a crew, fire on that, time them and train them.
But that isn't the same as a manned plane coming. Diving at
I don't know of any way you can simulate that. I guess the best way to simulate that is in a simulator, and they probably have those now. They had something like that at the end of the war. You go into this big training dome you got in your regular harness for your 20 millimeter or 40 millimeter gun. And then they would have motion pictures of these Supas diving. Coming in at different angles and using this.
That would be to train your reflexes more than it would be to develop new gunnery.
I don't think they have much today in the way of gunnery that they didn't have then. I'm not sure of that, but I don't think they have much in the way of new ammunition, some new ammunition perhaps, but for to keep to ward off attacks like that. It's mainly just getting a lot of stuff up there as well directed as you possibly can. You're getting the kind of crew training that will let you respond quickly, not too soon, not too late.
Now, before you were able to get back out into the war air zone, it had ended, I think.
Right, we had all our training completed on the Tucker, and we were headed for the Panama Canal when we got the orders to come back and join this task force in Portland, Maine. We operated between Portland, Maine and Boston. Get our modifications down in Boston and our support training up on Castle Bay. And we were up there much longer than we expected to be. I remember the wives came up and we were going to be there 3 weeks and we were going to be there another 3 weeks. They didn't know whether to go back or stay, you know, that kind of thing. And it went on and on. And we were up there when the war ended.
Why did you resign after the war ended?
I guess I was tired or something. I had a good job. I was with OPDEV 4 down in Austin. But I had a lot of sea duty. I didn't have much family life. I thought also that the Navy was probably headed for a long period of stagnation, you know, in ranks and that sort of thing. And I look back on it, it took, it was either foolhardy or it took a lot of courage or something, I don't know. I was married at the time, she was two boys, and I had a career there. But I guess I felt I could make it.
Did you go directly to the FBI when you left?
Exactly. I think they put on Friday and went on FBI on Monday. And stayed around, went through training, and then went to Detroit. Was in the Detroit field office, operating out of there up north, northern part of Michigan. And then came back here. Got involved in this plain routine work around here.
What was the nature of the work with the FBI?
Well, out in Detroit, it was everything. We'd take off on Monday morning with a briefcase full of leads on different kinds of cases. It could be bank robbery, it could be kidnapping, it could be a background investigation. We were doing a lot of background investigations at that time. Anything. So we're crawling under the reports on this colored person's house, bad section there, and digging out a jar of money that had been stolen and buried under there. That sort of thing. You got a lead sheet, you know, go to such and such an address, do this, do that, sort of thing, interview so and so, and report back. And you go do that, and then you go to the next town and do something else. It was hard work, 6 days a week. And came back. I was out there for, I think, something like 8 months or so, maybe a year, and then came back here. And here it was just everybody in town was working on what we call applicant work. It was the Marshall Plan group had to be cleared, and the Greek Turkey aid bill official had to be cleared. Everybody coming into the CIA had to be cleared. So it was all just neighborhood investigations, background work.
Well, does the FBI get involved in the routine background investigations for security clearances, for example.
Right.
That's an enormous number of military personnel alone.
Well, I think now we did it. The FBI did it for CIA until CIA could do it itself. And now the CIA did all of their own. And the military did all of their own. The FBI just couldn't possibly handle it. Because they handled a lot of the senior officials in the executive department. And I think that's about where they stopped. Federal judges and so forth. Because they couldn't possibly have an enormous organization.
Oh, it'd be so unyieldy to... Mr. Hoover, of course, has been very controversial in recent years and since his death. What was the feeling of the agents toward him at this time?
He was God, Mr. God, benevolent to his agents in a way, but a very, very tight ship. If you had a new baby, you got a congratulatory message. I lost my oldest boy with polio as an agent. I got a letter of condolence signed by him and a call from a couple of senior officials. They were very attentive to those kind of amenities. On the other hand, if you stubbed your toe and embarrassed the Bureau, what worse thing you could do is embarrass the Bureau. You could take a $500 pay cut. The next day you went out and captured one of the 10 most wanted, you'd get a $1,000 raise. You see, he was one of the first officials who got the right to hire and fire at will without recourse to the normal requirement.
So he used the carrot and the stick.
And he used yes, he did. He was able to do that. And it wasn't until, I guess, the suit of has recently been in the newspapers about the Latinos not getting a fair shake. This is one of the first times I've ever heard of it. Against the FBI personnel policies. Now, there are a lot of agencies. CIA has the same policy today. The director can hire and fire at will without any recourse.
Well, I know in more recent years, and when you were with the Bureau, there were claims that there were a lot of investigations of public officials for the purpose of preparing rather sizable dossiers on them. Did you ever?
No.
Experience?
Never experienced that at all. I really didn't know. I think if it happened, it's overblown. I think it probably did happen.
And we have.
See, I left there in 1950, and he was a relatively young man at the time.
I think it was probably in the later years.
Later years, he became vindictive.
I know. I have a. That was what led me to inquire about that. From there, you got involved in nuclear weapons development.
Right.
Now, was this for the Navy, or was in what capacity
was
this?
Well, the organization that I went to when I recall, 50, was the Joint Atomic Energy Weapons Program, called Armed Forces Special Weapons Project, and they handled nuclear weapons for all three services, for the Army, Navy, the Air Force. They did all the development. The AEC did all of the development work to meet requirements stated by the Army, Navy, and the Air Force. Maybe one would want a 2,000-pound air-deliverable weapon at 20 kilotons. AEC would develop that weapon out of Sandia Corporation in Los Alamos.
Well, now, was this a reaction to the Korean War, or was this something that would have been in the works anyway?
Well, it would have been in the works anyway, because we were in the very, very tight race with the Soviet Union of very tight race, and we knew we had to stay ahead of that, because whereas we can have weapons like that and not use them except to maintain peace, I don't think that the same would hold true. So they had the wherewithal to conquer the world or to subdue the world, they would have done so.
How did you get involved in nuclear weapons? Led you into that?
Gunnery experience. All my experience in the Navy was gunnery. During the war, I was a gunnery officer and fire control officer. So when I went back on, they formed this joint group, and they needed a person in the gunnery background experience. So I went into that. I was called into that group. Said, "There you're going to be." Went out to the Naval Ordnance Lab at White Oaks first. It was merely working on forming up test teams to go out to Nevada to measure the effects of atomic weapons, radiation, overpressure, fallout, Earth movements, acceleration.
You said you've been pretty good in physics, so I reckon that came in handy.
Yeah, so I put it to use out there. Went out on two or three trips, two or three series of shots out there, and then came back and went to the Pentagon as chief of training for three services. Good job. But I like training anyway.
But you were considered to be an active naval, Navy duty.
Navy commander. Made commander. An active duty in uniform. And didn't wear a uniform out in Nevada. Wear work clothes out there. Pretty primitive living, but then when I came after I finished two or three series of tests, because that was pretty isolated duty, go out there and stay for, you know, 2 or 3 months at a time, those test shots. And they phased down the test program somewhat, so I went into the headquarters group and was chief of training, most of the training being at Sandia Base. I spent a lot of time out there. TDYs out there, and designing training courses for maintenance of the weapons, for delivery of the weapons, for staff officers studying the effects of atomic weapons. We did an exercise one time on how many weapons it would take to help the French get out of trouble at Dien Bien Phu. Size weapons, where would they be, should they be placed, and so on. I don't know where the request came from or why it came, but we did the work. Fortunately, we were used for that. So that was why I was there, and I stayed in that, on that job for 5 years until I went back off active duty. And then the man who was the technical director for weapons development team came over to be the chief technical intelligence officer for CIA, and he asked me to come over and be the deputy chief of the nuclear energy division in CIA.
Well, now, what would the CIA have, what would their involvement be in the nuclear energy field?
Well, our principal job there was to develop estimates of Soviet capabilities. A very, very tough job. We had no intelligence whatsoever coming out of there that we could depend upon. And we were reaching back to, there was some German scientists returning from the Soviet Union, having been over there for several years. They were kept mostly in the research institutes rather than up in the weapons production. But we would measure every nuclear blast that came out of the Soviet Union.
Did you try to develop intelligence sources within the Soviet Union?
Yes and no. The only thing you could, we did, yes. You study everything. You're not going to get a bomb and measure and that sort of thing. So you start with the with the scientific aspects of it. What are they studying? Heavy water. Are they studying uranium? Are they studying other exotic metals? How many men are they sending out to the uranium? How many shovels are they sending out to supply men who are out in the uranium field? You get into those kinds of tenuous
measures. Very basic.
How do you measure? You're not going to get it. In those days, we didn't have overflights. You see, we
did satellites.
Satellites. So you, how many rail cars of ore could you count in East Germany? And there you would get an agent to help you count those rail cars, you see. You'd try to get a meter to measure the radioactivity. You'd try to get a sample to measure the uranium content of the ore. Radium content of the ores would be, you know, so many grams per ton of the uranium. They've got so many tons in each car and so many cars, therefore you develop these kind of esoteric measurement systems. And once you get the amount of uranium ore, then how much is going to be converted to plutonium, and how much to U-235, where is this done, how much is
it? I hate to cut this off because I'm really interested in this, but if you were to make your 6:30 appointment, I'm afraid I'm going to be running you very kind of short.
I'm fine. I got a 10-minute walk and a 10-minute drive.
So we're having a little better. Close it now. You know, sit at 6:30.
So the intelligence, the whole purpose of our